From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. A new show celebrating the work of choreographer Bob Fosse opened this week on Broadway. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from two dancers who worked with Fosse. Gwen Verdon originated roles in Chicago, Damn Yankees, and Sweet Charity, and was also married to him. Verdon is the artistic advisor to the new show. And Bebe Neuwirth, who starred in the recent revival of Chicago. Also, we remember Jamie Hammerstein, Broadway producer, director, and son of composer Oscar Hammerstein. He died last week. We'll listen back to a 1995 interview with him. And John Powers reviews Terrence Malick's new film, The Thin Red Line. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate impeachment trial of President Clinton has adjourned for the evening after another day in which House prosecutors argued their case for removing the president from office. Chief Justice William Rehnquist made his first substantive ruling in the trial today. NPR's Dale Willman's been following the trial. Dale, what happened today?
Well, Corey, this ruling came following a Democratic objection over the use of the word juror. Tom Harkin of Iowa interrupted Representative Bob Barr as he was presenting the House's case, saying later Republicans were attempting to narrow the options of the Senate in deciding the president's fate by their use of the term. His concern, he said, was that the Founding Fathers had given the Senate the role of both jury and judge in impeachment proceedings, but by identifying them as jury only, it would limit them to considering just the facts, but not the good of the country as well. Rehnquist sustained the objection. The full Senate, meanwhile, spent a second day listening to Republican House members present their case against the president, including suggestions that the president himself testify, a suggestion Democratic lawmakers said was unlikely to be acted upon. The hearing continues tomorrow for the final few hours of the Republican presentation before the White House presents its case next week.
Thank you. NPR's Dale Willman. John Hinckley, who was confined to a mental hospital after trying to assassinate former President Ronald Reagan, may be able to make supervised day trips. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
A divided federal appeals court ruled that even though the court cannot determine whether Hinckley can leave the hospital, his doctors can. In the past, the doctors have said brief trips would help Hinckley's treatment, so this opens a way for Hinckley to see his family and friends under the supervision of hospital personnel. Hinckley has been confined to St. Elizabeth's Hospital since 1982, a year after he tried to shoot President Reagan to impress actress Jodie Foster. Hinckley sought permission to visit his family and girlfriend a year ago, but federal prosecutors intervened. They argued that he still suffers from personality disorders. A judge agreed with the prosecutors, but the federal appeals court overturned the decision today. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Russia has submitted a plan to the United Nations Security Council that calls for eliminating UNSCOM, the weapons inspection system in Iraq. The Russian plan would replace UNSCOM with a new monitoring center based in New York with an office in Baghdad. The monitoring center would be directly controlled by the committee of all the Security Council members, thereby giving it much less autonomy than UNSCOM. The Russian plan follows proposals submitted by France and the United States this week in an effort to come up with a new policy toward Iraq following the airstrikes against Iraq by the U.S. and Britain. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 219 points to close at 9,340. This is NPR. Bell Atlantic says it has called off its bid to acquire AirTouch Communications, the nation's second-largest independent cellular phone company. The surprise announcement came after 2 weeks of talks in which the regional phone giant reportedly offered about $45 billion for AirTouch. Bell Atlantic's decision to bow out leaves the British company, Vodafone, as the only remaining bidder for AirTouch. Vodafone, which is Britain's largest cellular phone operator, offered $55 billion for AirTouch last week. The Baltimore Orioles owner, Peter Angelos, and a delegation of baseball and charity officials flew to Cuba today to hold talks about a possible exhibition series in Havana and Baltimore. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The Orioles' plan is to play an exhibition game in Havana in March, with the Cuban national team returning soon after for a second game in Baltimore. The Baltimore Orioles owner, Peter Angelos, has been trying for more than 2 years without luck to arrange such a series. The Orioles have already donated baseball equipment to the Catholic Church for distribution in Cuba. Last week, the Clinton administration announced it would finally approve the Orioles' request to explore the possibility of an exhibition series, but the Cuban government would have to agree that any earnings from the series would go to a Cuban Catholic Church charity. Angelos left for Havana, accompanied by his son, a representative of Catholic Relief Services, and officials from Major League Baseball. A Major League team has not played in Havana since the Brooklyn Dodgers held spring training there in 1947. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 71 points today. That's more than 3%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Fosse, a musical tribute to the choreography of the late Bob Fosse, opened last night on Broadway. It features some of Fosse's most memorable dance numbers, including choreography from his musicals Sweet Charity, Damn Yankees, and Dancin', and his movies Kiss Me Kate, Cabaret, and All That Jazz. On today's archive edition, we'll hear from two of Fosse's most well-known dancers. A little later in the show, Bebe Neuwirth talks about working with Fosse and her role in the revival of the musical Chicago. But first, Gwen Verdon. She's the artistic advisor of the new show. Bob Fosse created his first and most memorable Broadway shows, Damn Yankees, Sweet Charity, and Chicago, for Verdon, who was his wife at the time. Verdon is a four-time Tony Award winner and the standard against which many Broadway dancers are measured. Here's Gwen Verdon singing one of her numbers from Sweet Charity.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those Stumbo bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first rate chums I attract. All I can say is, wow, we look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pow, right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now.
Since retiring from the stage, Verdon has acted in films and on television. Terry talked with her in 1993.
Your mother was a dancer and a dance teacher.
Yes.
So I imagine you grew up in an atmosphere where there was a lot of dance.
I thought everybody danced. I thought every mother and every daughter danced because she was also a performer. And I would go with her. I'm speaking of being 2 years old. And I just thought that all those women had children and that everybody danced.
Now, I read about you that you had rickets when you were very young. And,
yes.
And that damaged your legs.
You're born that way. I guess it's from some kind of malnutrition. But with corrective exercise, not surgery, which they wanted to do, and my mother wouldn't allow it, but the orthopedic surgeon explained to her that one muscle was too long on the outside of the leg, and the inner muscle on the leg. That one was too long, and the outside one was too short, so it would allow the knee joint to swing out, so my legs made an X.
Huh.
If you can picture that. Anyway, she decided to, through exercise, shorten the inner muscle and stretch the outside one.
And did that work?
It sure did, that and corrective boots. They never operated.
What did the corrective boots look like?
Oh, God. They were just dreadful. They were big, high-top brown things, and the heel was very crooked. It would make me walk on the outsides of my feet so that the inner muscle would stay short. I must say it worked because within, I would say 2 to 4 years, my legs looked straight, though I had to wear these shoes, corrective shoes, whenever I was home or in school.
I don't understand how you were able to dance with your knee, with your legs in such bad shape and having to wear these corrective boots all the time.
Oh, no, I didn't dance with them on. And I did all kinds of exercises. My mother kept saying, yes, you're doing ballet, but instead of my heels being together in a turned out position, I was always doing everything with my toes as much together as possible, which would keep stretching that outside muscle.
So you did almost corrective dance?
Oh, absolutely.
I guess I'm wondering if you were ever self-conscious when you started to dance on stage, since you grew up so self-conscious about your legs.
You know, I was so young when I began performing that I don't remember being self-conscious. I do remember in 1959, I think it was, again it was Redhead, and it was the first time I ever read reviews. And I never read reviews on any of the other shows. And in Redhead, they kept calling me a great beauty, an Arlene Dahl type, who is a great beauty. And I became very embarrassed, I did develop a stage fright.
After that review, you developed stage fright?
Yes.
Why did that review lead to stage fright? It's such a flattering review. Why did it lead to stage fright?
It's very flattering, but I've never thought, and I still don't, and I know it's the truth. I am not a great beauty. I feel like one on stage, but I certainly don't look like one.
But don't you think a lot of beauty on stage comes from projecting that feeling?
I agree. But somehow, I mean, I felt very good and very secure, strangely enough, when they said I looked like a red-haired Fanny Brice, or a female Charlie Chaplin. And, I mean, I'm honored to be compared to people like that. But I felt like an absolute fool being compared to Arlene Dahl. And I thought those critics must be sitting in the back row of the third balcony.
So that made you feel like a fraud?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you started getting stage fright, what were the symptoms and how did you deal with it?
I would shake. My mouth would go dry. And I was afraid to be on stage.
Who would somebody have to talk you onto stage?
I'd get out there and then panic.
Well, you can't panic on stage, though.
Well, I did. They say you can't sneeze on stage, but I did.
What's a time when you actually panicked on stage?
It, again, was during Redhead. And I would be out there with the entire cast, and everyone would leave, and I would have to sing a song. And sometimes I would just walk off and get my aunt, with whom I had to play the next scene. And I'd just skip the song. I couldn't sing it.
What would the director say when you did that?
He was my husband. He understood. He sent me to an excellent doctor, and I was fine. But then I was also given an article to read about Laurence Olivier, who also had stage fright and would turn his back. Everyone thought, what a unique way of playing, being an actor, to be able to turn your back on the audience and play a scene. So whenever I would get this feeling, because then by that time I'd be afraid of being afraid, and when that would happen, I would turn my back and sing the song. And it worked.
Did people in the audience assume that this was innovative stage direction?
Well, if it worked for Laurence Olivier, it was going to certainly have to work for me.
My guest is one of the great Broadway stars of the 50s and 60s, Gwen Verdon. This is Gwen Verdon in a show-stopping number from Damn Yankees.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind to have no regrets. Recline yourself, resign yourself, you're through. I always get what I aim for. And your heart and soul is what I came for. Whatever Lola wants.
I think Damn Yankees was the first Broadway show that you worked on with Bob Fosse, who later became your husband.
True.
What was it like the first time you worked with him and danced to his choreography? What was different about his choreography and direction from what you had experienced before?
The first thing that I noticed was it was so amusing. I know it was sensuous. I know it was all of those things. But it was done with such a sense of humor, and also done with the innocence of a child. So you weren't acting sexy. It just came out that way. Nope. And I was amazed at the training, because I had excellent training in many disciplines of dance. And I was amazed at how disciplined and what was required with Bob's work.
What was required of you that you...
Ballet, tap, isolation, which I had learned from East Indian dancing. And, I mean, there was his humor. I had worked with Jack Cole, who always did very sensuous women. He did Gilda for that number, Gilda from the movie Gilda for Rita Hayworth, I think. He's probably more famous for that number. But it's not funny. And Bob would do the same kind of thing, not the same steps, but his point of view was the flip side of that. It was just making fun of being sexy, which comes out much more sexy.
Do you feel that you played Lola, the devilish seductress, as funny?
I played it as a child. Have you seen little girls all dressed up in their mother's clothes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and lipstick smeared all over their face. I did it like that.
When you said that there was isolation required for Bob Fosse's choreography, do you mean like just moving one shoulder or an elbow or just like one part of the body?
Yes. And it was extremely musical. That was up to Bob. I mean, the music was the groundwork, but he would catch every little thing. If you moved your little finger, there would be a ting on a triangle. So, and there was an economy to the movement. You didn't just sort of blast out and dance. It was isolation and discipline. That's the only thing I can think of.
Would he do the moves to show you what he wanted?
Yes, and they were hysterical. And I once said, I don't think I can do that in high heels. So Bob put on high heels and did it.
Oh, no.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
well, he believed me, but he had to find out for himself.
Well, could he do it in high heels?
Sure he could.
So then you were forced to do it.
Not forced. I thought, as soon as I could see how he did it in heels.
What was the trick?
It was not a trick. It was a certain step in Lola where you keep twisting, and I kept thinking the heels are, one heel is going to scrape by my other foot.
So what was the solution he came up with?
Just do it. And if you're turned in enough... You had to be very turned in, which worked just great for me because that's how I studied dance. That's how my mother taught me when I was two.
Because of your muscle problems.
Yes.
You work with Bob Fosse on several musicals, New Girl in Town, Redhead, Chicago, Sweet Charity, as well as Damn Yankees. Were there particular things that he liked to use you for that he thought of as being Gwen Verdon moves, you know, that were just saved for you?
No, you know, because you can do the same movement on somebody else. And because they're built differently and have a different point of view, it does not look the same. And Bob was very good about, I guess, using what the person had. I don't know what I've got, but I know when Annie Rankin replaced me in the show, she has great legs and she can jump even in high heel shoes. I was never a jumper, even barefoot. And so Bob would use this extension that Annie had and the fact that she could leap like that, great grand jeté. And so he would change the steps.
Once you and Bob Fosse were married, was it any harder or easier to work together?
No, because I never thought of him when we were working as my husband. In fact, Judy Garland came backstage one time and she said, "Oh, your husband's done a fabulous job." And I actually said, "Who?" I don't associate that at all.
Why was it easier to not think of him as your husband?
It was not that I just did not think of him. He was the director. He was the choreographer. He wasn't my husband when we were working.
Gwen Verdon with Terry Gross in 1993. Coming up, we hear from B.B. Newworth. This is Fresh Air. If Gwen Verdon originated many of Fosse's most enduring roles, B.B. Newworth became one of the stars of the Fosse revivals. She starred in the revival of Damn Yankees and in Sweet Charity in Chicago, which each won her a Tony Award. Off-Broadway, she's best known for her role as Dr. Lilith Crane, the pretentious shrink on Cheers and Frasier. Last night, B.B. Newworth returned to her role as Velma Kelly in Chicago for a two-week run. Terry spoke with Newworth in 1997, when she first starred in Chicago. Here she is in the opening number.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz, start the car, I know a whoopee spot where the gin is cold but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly brawl. And all that jazz.
B.B. Newworth, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You know, watching you dance in Chicago, I thought, well, how could you possibly be content in a performance without dancing? You just dance so wonderfully.
You're actually right. I'm not completely content in a performance without dancing. I have been dancing since I was very, very young, and my first stage experiences from the age of seven continuously have been in ballets and dancing. And so you're absolutely right. I really don't feel like I've given a complete performance unless unless I start, you know, kicking my legs around at some point, unless I start dancing. So as much as I have enjoyed a lot of the other work that I've done, I always do feel like something is missing from the experience. Something didn't get covered.
Now, I know that, I think this is your third Bob Fosse musical. You were in a revival of Sweet Charity. You were in the mm-hmm. dance anthology show Dancin'. Could you talk a little bit about how Fosse choreography is different, how it uses the body differently than other choreographers who you've worked with, or than ballet even?
Yeah. Well, actually, I find that people who have very strong training in ballet do better, actually, with the Fosse choreography than those who lack the ballet background. If you ever saw the guy, and if you saw the way he stood and moved around a room and looked at you when he talked to you, you understand his movement. A lot of it is simply based on his posture. He was a little slope-shouldered, a little hunched. His hips were a little forward. He was a little knock-kneed and turned in. And wildly sexy without being, you know, in-your-face sexy. He was just a very, very, there was something really attractive about him. And it was kind of sly. And, you know, the way he looked up and looked at you. If you get the feeling of that, if you understand that, then you understand something about the movement that will make it not, that will fill out the movement. You know, you could technically replicate the steps, but if you don't understand that essence of it, then you're not going to really make the movement dance.
In Fosse choreography, there's a lot of like pelvis swivels and shoulder swivels and elbows moving. And
it's a lot of isolation.
Yeah. Yes. Did you have to learn how to move parts of your body that you hadn't thought of as dance parts before, or how to coordinate them in a different way?
No, I have to say, I don't know why, but it... Ever since the first time I saw Fosse choreography when I was 13 and saw Pippin, I just, that movement spoke to me, and it was quite clear and quite, I just understood it, and it made absolute perfect sense. You know, it sounds very simple, but it actually requires a great deal of control,
mm-hmm.
and control physically, you know, that a ballet dancer has, especially the ability to be pulled up and very centered. And also, in a way, it requires a control taste-wise. Fosse choreography is never vulgar. It's very, very sexy. It's very, very sensual. But it is never vulgar, and there is a line. You could be doing hip isolations, you could be doing shoulder isolations, these very, very sexy moves, but there's something elegant about them always. They could even be part of a show that's based on vaudeville, which is a pretty bawdy medium. But there is something that is not vulgar. It is elegant.
Bebe Neuwirth from a 1997 interview with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more conversation with Bebe Neuwirth about performing on stage and her role as Lilith, the uptight shrink on Cheers. Also, we remember Jamie Hammerstein, Broadway producer and son of Oscar Hammerstein. He died last week. And John Powers reviews The Thin Red Line. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's continue now with Terry's interview with Bebe Neuwirth. To television audiences, she's best known for playing Lilith, Frasier's wife, on Cheers and on Frasier. Terry spoke with Neuwirth in 1997 about her starring role in the revival of the musical Chicago.
The cast recording of Chicago has just come out, and I want to play another track from it. I'm going to play your part of a song called Cell Block Tango. This takes place in jail, where you are being held on charges of murdering your husband and sister.
Yes.
And the part of the song that we're going to hear tells your story. So why don't we hear it?
My sister Veronica and I did this double act, and my husband Charlie used to travel around with us. Now, for the last number in our act, we did 20 acrobatic tricks in a row. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Split, spread eagles, backflips, flip-flops, one right after the other. Well, this one night we were in Cicero, the three of us, sitting up in a hotel room, boozing, having a few laughs, and we ran out of ice, so I went out to get some. I come back, open the door. There's Veronica and Charlie doing number 17, the spread eagle. Well, I was in such a state of shock, I completely blacked out. I can't remember a thing. It wasn't until later, when I was washing the blood off my hands, I even knew they were dead. They had it coming. They had it coming. They had it coming all along. I didn't do it. But if I'd done it, how could you tell me that I was wrong?
That's Bebe Neuwirth from the new cast recording of Chicago. You have a very deep, strong voice. Now, do you think that your voice has affected the kinds of roles that you've been considered appropriate for? And I'm thinking that often on Broadway, the women's leading roles often seem to be written for a higher voice.
Mm. Yeah, they have this sort of formula with most musicals, most classically structured musicals. The leading lady is a soprano, and who, you know, doesn't necessarily dance. Maybe she'll move around a little bit, but she's not a dancer. She's a singer, and she's an ingenue and a soprano. And then she's got her best friend, who's got a belting voice, and she's a great dancer, and she's tough as nails, and has a heart of gold, and she's funny.
God, that's so true, isn't it?
Yeah. So I've played a lot of those parts.
The best friend?
Yeah.
What musicals are you the
Tough
best friend
nails,
in?
Heart of Gold. Sweet Charity. Nikki Pignatelli to Charity. Even Sheila, in a way, and Sheila in A Chorus Line is a similar type of part. West Side Story is a similar kind of a part.
Were you Anita?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've done almost all of Cheetah Rivera's roles now.
That's true.
Thank God for Cheetah Rivera.
Because she originated the part in Chicago.
Yes. Yeah. There's a number called Velma Takes the Stand, where Velma, my character, describes what she thought she just might do once she gets takes the stand in her trial. Ways to, you know, win the jury over. And It should be very funny. And Cheetah Rivera was just amazing. And I was about 15 when I saw it. And just looking at that stage thinking, what the God? I just couldn't believe what she was doing. She was fantastic.
Describe what happens with the chair.
It's kind of hard to describe. I mean, I dance with it, on it, around it, on top of it, under it. I carry it, wiggle my butt, lay out on it. I did a production of Chicago about 5.5 years ago with Juliet Prowse in Long Beach, California. And Cheetah Rivera called the theater on opening night, and she said to me, "You make very good friends with that chair." That was her advice.
Why don't we hear the song that you were just referring to, When Velma Takes the Stand? This is Bebe Neuwirth.
Well, when I got on the stand, I thought I'd take a peek at the jury. Then I'd cross my legs like this, you know.
When Velma takes the stand.
Then when Harrison cross-examines me, I thought I'd give him this. And if he yells at me, I thought I'd tremble like this. Ooh, no, please don't.
When Velma takes the stand. Look at little Velma. See her. Give him hell.
much for me, you know, like real dramatic. Oh! Oh! Then I thought I'd get thirsty, and I'd say, please, someone, could I have a glass of water?
When Velma takes a stand, see that Kelly girl make that jury whirl. When she turns it on, she's gotta get it going, she's gotta go.
That's Bebe Neuwirth from the new cast recording of the musical Chicago. How did you first get the role as Lilith on Cheers?
I was in Los Angeles for a couple of months. When we did Sweet Charity on Broadway, we had a run in California, San Francisco, and L.A. And then we had a few months off while Debbie Allen was finishing up her season of Fame, and she was our star. And then we were going to start up for Broadway in the spring. So during those months, I was in Los Angeles, and I thought, well, might as well, you know, see if I can pick up, you know, some television work, because I'd never worked on television. That was sort of all there was in Los Angeles for me. And so it was just a one-shot deal on the show, just a one scene in one episode. And I read for it. I didn't think I was right at all for it, but went in and read, and that's what happened.
And then after your performance, they wanted to enlarge the role?
Well, the following season, I guess that was in January. So the following season, I was playing on Broadway in Sweet Charity, and they called up. They said, would you come and do another episode? So I went out and did another episode, and then that was in the fall. And then that winter, they said, oh, could you come and do another episode? So sure, I went out and did another episode. And then after Sweet Charity closed, they asked me if I would do, like, what was this thing where you would do four episodes, and then there was an option to pick you up for a 7 out of 13 player, you know, a part-time player on the show. And I had a really hard time deciding whether or not to do that. I mean, I remember sitting backstage during Sweet Charity with Michael Rupert, and who was playing Oscar in the show, and after I'd done an episode or two, and he said, now what would you do if they ask you to go out there and be on that show? I said, no way would I go out to Los Angeles and be on a TV show. Forget it. I'm on Broadway. I like Broadway. This is where I'm staying. And so I deliberated a very long time about that, and I had some, you know, advice from some people whose opinions I respect and are really smart about either me or about show business, and decided that it wouldn't be such a bad thing for me to do. And I'm very glad I did it.
You said that when you first read for the role of Lilith, you didn't think you were right for it. What was the role like that first time, and why didn't you think you were right
for
the part?
Well, the description of it was, I don't know, dry, no sense of humor, rigid, hair slicked back, intellectual, analytical, all this other stuff, you know, unattractive, older, also quite a bit older than I was. And all these things which were a description of parts that I would never have been sent up for. You know, as I said, I was always sent up for, you know, sexy, funny, tough as nails, heart of gold, you know, dancer, big belt. So it was a very unusual character description for me. And I actually was having a hard time cracking the script for a while, and then some character just occurred to me and really tickled me and made me laugh. So that was what I did at the audition.
See, that's the thing. You found a very funny way of playing somebody who's humorless.
Yeah.
And that, I guess that's the key. So can you talk a little bit how you did that?
I don't know. There's something funny about being humorless, isn't there? At least to me. I don't know. I think there's something funny about being really not funny at all.
I thought you were particularly funny during the pregnancy episodes, when it was as if you were the first woman ever to be pregnant.
Yeah,
and
right.
That you embodied all that is Mother Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, they asked me to do some good stuff on that show. They're great writers, great producers.
Can you talk about the pregnancy episodes?
I liked it. This one time we went off to a cabin. Kelsey and I went off to, or, you know, Fraser and Lilith went off to a cabin. And she was pregnant, and I guess this is just because I liked the episodes where I got to sing. I thought it was really funny that Lilith loved to sing. And I think I was singing My Funny Valentine, pregnant out there in the woods, freezing.
How did you sing as Lilith?
Well, I tried to sing pretty well, but I also tried to sing, you know, in her voice.
Could you demonstrate how that sounds?
My funny Valentine. But then they did a lovely thing. One time they had something about Lilith. I think the story was that the B story was that she had taken singing lessons so that she could sing to her child. And they did a really sweet thing when she sang this, what is it? It's an Al Jolson song, Sonny Boy. I actually got to sing Sonny Boy really sweetly to the baby, and it made everybody in the bar cry. That was fun.
Bebe Neuwirth talked with Terry in 1997. She's now back on Broadway, starring in the musical Chicago for a 2-week run. Coming up, we remember Jamie Hammerstein. This is Fresh Air. Jamie Hammerstein, a producer and frequent director of the musicals of his father, Oscar Hammerstein, died last week at the age of 67 of a heart attack. In his 40-year career in show business, Hammerstein directed the shows Damn Yankees, Harold Pinter's Tea Party, and Simon Gray's Wise Child, among others. After his father's death in 1960, he concentrated on revivals of the work of Rodgers and Hammerstein. In 1981, he staged the revival of Oklahoma, a 1990 production of The Sound of Music, and in 1996, the musical State Fair, which was adapted from the film. Terry spoke with Jamie Hammerstein in 1996.
Your family really has quite a theater legacy. I mean, your father, of course, was Oscar Hammerstein, the lyricist. Your grandfather was in vaudeville?
Yeah, he was a vaudeville producer. My great-uncle was an operetta producer. And my great-grandfather was Oscar I, who was an opera impresario, among other things. A real estate developer and vaudeville himself and an inventor.
So theater was the family business when you were growing up.
Yes, but you'd never know it. It was not what people imagine with Judy Garland running in with a tennis racket. I mean, it just wasn't. It seemed like, well, you know, it's the only life I had as a kid, so it seemed perfectly normal to me. And my father wrote in his study and for many hours every day, and he'd come out having, I'm sure, sweated bullets all day. And he would come out and go, who's winning the baseball game? Or do you want a game of tennis? Or, you know, and you'd never guess he'd been working for 8 hours trying to find a rhyme for Surrey, you know?
Well, did he walk around the house going, Surrey, scurry, Surrey, scurry?
No, he locked himself in, or he walked in down the we had a long yard where he would also pace. And we also, for one of his mother, built him a walk-around porch from his study so that nice weather, or even reasonable weather, he could take a walk by opening his study door. He always worked walking, and he was inaudible. I know he worked terribly hard, and I know he was a perfectionist. There's no doubt in my mind about those things, but he also could turn it off like a light and come out as one of the more normal people you've ever met.
I guess that's unusual in theater.
It's unusual with a writer, I think.
Normal.
It's unreasonable. I mean, I think it's unreasonable. Yeah, I think it's almost supernatural myself.
Your father was Stephen Sondheim's mentor. I think it was when Sondheim's parents divorced when he was, I don't know, 10 or 11 or something, that he and his mother moved to rural Pennsylvania, or suburban Pennsylvania, where your family was living.
You got the facts right, but the order wrong. His parents had been divorced. He was living with his mother, and he came out to play with me one weekend, because he's a year and a day older than me. I know that because we shared birthdays for year in and year out. And he came out because we had just met and liked one another, and we had a good time, and instead of going off to camp, he decided to stay. He was the boy who came to dinner. He never left. Then his mother moved out to be close to us and see her son once in a while. because he literally moved in. And I think, you know, it's odd. I was thinking last night about that and how much Steve owes my father, though I think he would be pretty much of a great writer if my father had not taken him in. But also my mother. I think that both my parents were kind of adopted by Steve and vice versa. And he was like another brother, I suppose.
How did you feel about him moving in?
I don't know. He didn't bother me that much. We had a good time. You know, we fought like brothers fight, but we didn't, I don't think I felt any great jealousy. My father had a strangely objective form of love, which sounds like an impossibility. And so it never became like a favoritism or, no, it just didn't happen. As far as I know, maybe I should go to a psychiatrist and find out what really happened.
Well, how old were you when your father became partners with Richard Rodgers?
I was about 11.
So what do you know about the story of how he started to work with Richard Rodgers?
Well, Dick was approached by the Theater Guild to make a musical out of Green Grow the Lilacs. And he went to Larry Hart. And Larry Hart said, I'm not interested. And Dick still thought he could persuade Larry and went to Dad just in case and said, if Larry quits on me in the middle of this, will you save me? And my father said, if Larry doesn't want to do it or quits, I will not only do it, but I'll let Larry's name stay on it if you like. I'll just sit in the back and do the work. And then Larry actually insisted that he didn't want to do it. And so Dick went back to Dad and said, no, this is yours. And that's how it happened.
It's always been so interesting to me and probably everybody else who listens to musicals, how different your father's lyrics were than Larry Hart's lyrics.
Yeah, but I think the really interesting part about it is how different Dick's music was.
Yeah, right. What do you perceive of how his music changed when your father became a lyricist?
They're totally different people. I mean, my goodness. I mean, Larry Hart and my father were night and day in the way they looked at life. My father was an optimist. My father believed optimism was the only useful thing to be. The pessimism was just a waste of time, basically. And my father was not into writing songs. My father was into was a dramatist who was also a lyricist. And Dick is a dramatist who's also a composer. And I think Dad gave Dick the chance to be a musical dramatist. I think Larry wrote songs. And my father wrote characters and plot and everything else in his songs.
What did your father think of Larry Hart's lyrics?
Oh, he loved most of them. I mean, I think Larry Hart... See, my father never had a great facility for strange and wonderful rhymes. Larry Hart did. So it's like there's no competition involved. My father could never write like Larry Hart. And my father, not being a fancy rhymer, just wrote very honestly and very easy to sing lyrics. But they were... I think he spent his time saying exactly what he wanted to say dramatically in what I think is the most difficult dramatic form you can write in, which is lyrics. You have to make things come out metrically. You've got to have rhymes, the right kind of rhymes, not too many of them if it's a serious song. If it's a light song, maybe triple rhymes, inside rhymes. It is something which takes years to master, and... I think my father mastered it, and he just trying to say what you want to say in that form is deadly difficult. You can get so seduced by a very clever rhyme. You can get so seduced by an easy rhyme. And it just takes a little bit of the edge of what you're really trying to say, and it goes on some tangent, which isn't too far off. So let's take that tangent and get it over with and go have a drink. And my father would never do it. He'd keep on, he'd just throw out more and more lyrics till he was saying what he wanted to say, and somehow it rhymed and was singable.
Jamie Hammerstein in a 1996 interview with Terry. He died last week at the age of 67. Let's hear Oh, What a Beautiful Morning from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, the breeze is so busy, don't miss a tree. An old weeping willow is laughing at me.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day.
Coming up, a review of The Thin Red Line. This is Fresh Air. The Thin Red Line marks the return to Hollywood of filmmaker Terrence Malick. The director of Badlands and Days of Heaven left Hollywood fed up nearly two decades ago. Now he's assembled a cast of stars and unknowns for his new movie, which is based on the James Jones war novel. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Terrence Malick's adaptation of The Thin Red Line is thrilling, frustrating, and utterly distinctive. A metaphysical war movie whose opening line asks, "What is this war at the heart of nature?" It tells the story of Charlie Company, which is fighting on Guadalcanal one hill at a time. Some of the soldiers cower. Others go mad, while still others, a lot of them, simply dash across the screen and die. The story centers on five vivid faces. There's Private Bell, played by Ben Chaplin, who's obsessed with memories of his wife back home. There's the decent Captain Staros, played by Elias Koteas, who's in constant conflict with the bullying Colonel Tall, that's Nick Nolte, because they have contrary attitudes about sacrificing the men. Above all, there's a spiritual debate between cynical Sergeant Welsh, he's Sean Penn, and the constantly AWOL Private Wit, played by Jim Caviezel, who sees the glory in nature. The two dispute the meaning of existence, as when Welsh offers his basic philosophical axiom.
In this world, a man himself is nothing. And there ain't no world but this one.
You're wrong there, Top. I've seen another world. Sometimes I think it was just my imagination.
Well, and you've seen things I never will.
It's not surprising that Malick would make his moral beacon a runaway soldier. After all, he's Hollywood's most famous AWOL, a genius on the run. When it was announced that this legend was making a new movie, famous actors lined up, but so did worrying questions. Could this visionary still make a movie after 20 years? Would he still be Terrence Malick? The answer is yes. The Thin Red Line is an absolutely personal film, from Malick's customary fondness for beautiful young male heroes to the way he portrays inner transformation by the deliberate burning of property. Never one to worry about the audience, he adopts a boldly avant-garde storytelling style in which characters appear and reappear, often without explanation. And yet the movie holds us and moves us. We feel the terror of battle and the loneliness of being a soldier. John Toll's photography is dazzling, without being prettified. Hans Zimmer's score has a burrowing melancholy, and Malick wins some amazing performances. Nolte's bellowing Tall, Chaplin's love-struck Bell, whose face has a silent movie expressiveness, and Penn's Welsh, a restrained piece of acting that's his best in years. Malick's one of the handful of filmmakers whose work contains a vision of life. This is both a down-and-dirty movie where men fight in the mud, and a meditation on the endless struggle between darkness and light in all of nature. The movie begins with a sinister crocodile sliding into water and ends with a life-affirming image of a plant growing from a rock. From start to finish, the screen is suffused with the natural world. Light shining through trees, wounded birds, cobras slithering among the soldiers. Malick is suggesting that animals and men, and even rocks, are part of a huge oversoul. At the beginning of the film, the AWOL wit has a vision of utopian harmony when he hides out among the beatific Melanesian people. This vision lets him see life more deeply than others. He's kinder than anyone to the terrified Japanese POWs. And it leads him in the end to become Malick's very own Prince Mushkin, a Christ figure whose seeming naivete is actually wisdom. Still, this attempt to evoke the transcendent is far from perfect. Malick's use of the beautiful, smiling Melanesians is corny and retro, as are the relentlessly lovely flashbacks to Belle's wife, who starts resembling a woman from a tampon commercial. But these are only local failings. Far more damaging is the movie's editing style, which tries to cobble together an unruly story by giving us several characters' interior monologues. Most of these voiceovers are dreadful, overwritten, redundant, and as explicit as a bullet in the head. About halfway through, we want these voices to shut up and let the imagery take us to a new level of awareness. The trouble is, Malick's vision of life doesn't deepen or grow more complicated as the story progresses. He sees the world from such an abstract height that he obliterates history. Was there really no relevant difference between the values that the Japanese and the Americans were fighting for? And he ignores the kind of undignified but all too human preoccupations that Jones wrote about so compellingly in his original novel. If The Thin Red Line could have incorporated all of this, it would have been a masterpiece. As it is, it's merely a film that anyone who cares about movies ought to see.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne Maria Baldonado. Today's program was produced by Kathy Wolf. Bob Hurtick is our engineer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, for Martin Luther King Day, we revisit the peak years of the Civil Rights Movement, 1963 to 65. We talk with Taylor Branch, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his first book on the Civil Rights Movement. His second volume, Pillar of Fire, has just been published in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Thank you.